Rav Herman's Chug.
So I want to read a little bit of a book out loud, and I want to use this as a paradigm, which is spelled paradigm.
No, that's the key to being a spelling champion, is to pronounce words properly in your mind.
For a greater lesson, which I think is valuable for all of us. What is it?
So he was a spelling champ for 2 years in a row.
You were a spelling champ, Aaron Yaakov?
Regional spelling champion.
What?
Regional spelling champion.
Oh, wow.
I didn't get a stick because the things on
track. How do you spell onomatopoeia?
That was one of those words. I had no clue. It's also in cursive, so it's really hard.
Ah, very good. Spelling champ.
Wow. Cursive? You need to put swear words in?
No. Spread around the table.
So I'd like to do this. I want to read a little bit of a book. And then this book is called Raising Good Children. Now this book was written. This is only good if you at one point were a child or are a child. I'd say were. Or will one, or is one day planning to have children. So it would apply to most of us.
Or you
want to be a kid again. Or you're a kid at heart. Okay, so if you don't mind listening, I usually don't read books out loud. I usually try to be original, but this is a gewaldig to read. Now, this book, I want you also to keep in mind, this is written 25 years ago, so it's a little bit old-fashioned. Like, it's a little bit behind the times.
Should we beat our kids or shouldn't we beat our kids?
Well, we're not going to talk about beating. I'm just
better,
reading.
Better chapter.
I'm reading
We talked about this.
I'm reading chapter 16.
One of the Monday sermons.
What book is that, Rabbi?
It's called Raising Good Children.
Hey, Engel.
It's not a good book. It's not a Jewish book. Meaning it's written by a Goy, for Goyim.
By Goyim.
By Goyim.
I hope I'm going to enjoy it.
So, in fact, it's for us.
Here it is.
For them, by us.
Television. We call it a lot of unflattering names. The Idiot Box. The Boob Tube. The Flickering Blue-Eyed Parent. The Plug-In Drug. And yet, we have allowed it to reshape our personal lives, our reading habits, our sleeping and eating patterns. Remember, I used to stay up late to watch certain shows. Late night TV was always great, like 2 in the morning, or good movies. How much we entertain and visit friends, the way we interact as families, more than any other technological innovation of the 20th century. More serious, we've even allowed TV, without realizing it, to replace us as our children's primary moral teacher. When parents hear statistics on how much time kids spend in front of the TV set, most are shocked. Preschoolers watch an average of 4 hours a day. Before, in the kindergarten, they would spend more time watching TV than a student spends in 4 years of college classes. The average elementary school child watches 30 hours of television a week. Junior high school kids watch even more. By the time they graduate from high school, kids will have spent some 15,000 hours watching TV, compared to 11,000 hours in the classroom. Sure, there are good programs for kids. Shows like Little House on the Prairie, Mr. Rogers, The Muppet Show.
He died.
I love Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street.
I heard Mr. Rogers.
By the way,
I'm a really mean man.
He goes to Sesame Street.
By the way, I'm reading this before Jack comes, so I don't insult his uncle.
But Jack has his MP3 player, though.
In the college courses I teach, teachers tell me that almost... Guys, I need, if you don't mind, just a few minutes of
silence.
Just a few minutes of silence. Okay, so that I can't read so much. So what's it called? So here is... here is a kindergarten teacher. Another kindergarten teacher asked her children, "What do you do after school?" Most answered, "I sit with mom and watch the soap opera until the cartoons come on." Okay. "You don't go out and play?" "No." "I wasn't surprised by that answer," the teacher says, "because they live out this stuff in the classroom. In the housekeeping corner, they play Guiding Light." That's a soap opera. "A typical play session will start like this. You're pregnant by him." These are 5-year-olds. "You're running away with her. You get shot. In case you haven't seen the soaps recently, here's what the kids are watching on a typical week of Guiding Light. Amanda tells Derek to start divorce proceedings for her and Ben. If Alan continues to avoid Hope, she will dissolve her marriage and deny the baby she's carrying is Alan's. Ed and Rita agree on a legal separation. Rita prepares for romantic interlude with Alan. Mike's, by the way, Alan is also, Hope is also pregnant with Alan. By the way, my English name is Alan. Mike suspects Alan has a mistress. In an attempt to win Russ back, Vanessa takes overdose of pills and liquor and calls Russ to save her. But he is not home. This is before the advent of cell phones. Nola succeeds in getting Floyd to spread rumors to Tim about Kelly. Breaking into Andy's apartment, Joe steals Andy's bank statements. This was tame compared to some. Here's a slice of life from Days of Our Lives, same week. This is true. After signing divorce papers and being institutionalized at Bayview Sanitarium, Lee says she just wants to be loved. In a crazed state, Kellum loads gun intending to kill Alex, Joshua, and Max. Alex wants Sister Mary to leave church for him. Marlena is raped by Kellum. Kellum wonders whether he's a man or a woman. No, this I made up.
That's in the 2000 episodes. We haven't watched that far already.
Right.
You'll feel so.
Neil Postman, professor of communications at NYU and author of the recent book, The Disappearance of Childhood, reminds us that one of the main differences between adults and children used to be that we knew things they didn't. But TV, with incredible swiftness, has changed all that. Drug addictions, incest, promiscuity, corruption, adultery, violence, and sadism are all becoming familiar to kids as they are to adults. All of this flies smack in the face of what was recently part of our civilization's wisdom, that childhood is a period to be protected and nurtured, a time of innocence and curiosity and trust. Very necessary for children's healthy development. Young children, of course, are not the only ones who stand to be disillusioned and corrupted by TV saturation in the seamy side of life. Teenagers, at a time in their moral development when they're highly impressionable, can easily develop a warped picture of human relationships from a constant diet of such fare.
Oh, Evan, where do you keep your sharp knives?
That's a good question. Says a mother of a 14-year-old girl, all of my daughter's religious friends watch the soap operas religiously. The first thing when they get home from school, and I mean religiously, they get on the phone and talk about it for an hour. I told Karen I didn't like her watching that stuff, but she didn't want to be cut out of the action. And it's not just the soaps or an occasional trashy show that present kids with values that are contrary to what most parents believe. Observes the publication Television and Movie Facts for Parents. A few years ago, the television good guys with whom youngsters identify, the lawyers, detectives, doctors, policemen, and policewomen, began as if somebody gave a signal to sleep around. If the chief heroes and heroines appear to be happy, successful, and promiscuous, and viewing America seems to improve, why would a teenager be inclined to be strict with himself? If kids are watching such shows week in and week out, they're getting regular reinforcement for the immature moral reasoning that says, if everybody's doing it, can it be so bad? Other values lessons kids learn from TV, besides casual attitudes towards... My kid alone? It rhymes with FedEx. And the idea that the promise of fidelity shouldn't be taken too seriously. What other values is TV teaching? If you're having trouble getting what you want, try violence or crime. By age 12, the average American child will have viewed approximately 100,000 violent episodes on TV and see 13,000 people violently destroyed. Cartoons, the mainstay of children's programming, contain per hour an average of 26 incidents of physical force intended to hurt or kill.
The Simpsons.
Nobody has yet counted the incidents of robbery, arson, bombing, forgery, smuggling, and psychological terror that kids are exposed to on the screen. With the advent of Home Box Office, it's HBO, which I'm sure nobody needs anymore, but it used to be a very popular...
Skokie has HBO.
Skokie has HBO.
Honors Bikia's option.
People used to watch it for movies. An alarming number of children are viewing new levels of graphic violence, not to mention sex. A second grade teacher in the average middle class community told me recently, I did a survey. Of the 22 kids in my class, all but 7 have HBO. Of those that have it, only 4 say they have any restrictions on what they can watch. The rest describe in vivid detail all the violence and gore they watch on Homebox, often with their parents in the room. Here's the research. At the University of North Carolina Child Development Center, researchers paired 10 preschoolers who were alike in their television and play habits. For the next 11 days, one child in each pair was shown a violent Saturday morning TV show, while his partner was shown a nonviolent show. No change occurred in the kids who watched nonviolent fare, but the preschoolers who watched violent programming showed a sharp increase in aggression, some even tripling their violent behavior, kicking, hitting, choking, etc. Doctors Jerome and Dorothy Singer, directors of Yale University Television Center, who probably have a very boring marriage because they're both professors at Yale, report similar findings. Maybe they have a happy marriage, or they're Jewish. They must be happy. Report similar findings in their year-long study of nursery schoolers. 3- and 4-year-olds who watch the most violent television are most likely to get into fights and disrupt others' games in nursery school. A study of juvenile offenders commissioned by ABC Television found that 22% confessed to having learned their criminal techniques from TV shows. You should know. It would never have occurred to me to rape a woman unless I... Like, does anyone here ever have a type to just go and just rape a woman? I mean, it's sick.
No one admits but you've, they did.
But you've seen it, not to sleep with a woman, to rape a woman. But people see it on TV, are like, oh yeah, there's such a thing exists. Otherwise, I never would have known such... I mean, I still, Baruch Hashem, have no such desires, but I never would have even thought that such a thing exists until I saw it on TV. No, there are people who have such inclinations. But many people are talking. A study of juvenile offenders commissioned by ABC Television... In an extensive investigation of the roots of childhood aggression, University of Illinois psychologist Dr. Leonard Eron and his colleagues studied 875 8-year-old children. 10 years later, they did a follow-up. And here are their findings. Child-rearing practices appear to contribute to children's aggression. Parents who are high in their use of physical punishment or low in love for their children tended to have the most aggressive youngsters. Although parents seem to play a part in shaping a child's aggression, TV violence appeared to play an even stronger one. The single best predictor of how an aggressive young man was at age 19 was the amount of violence he watched at age 8. There was no such relationship for girls in this study. Girls are usually less violent. Now, in 1977, Dr. Eron and associates began a second study. They measured the television viewing habits of 756 to 10-year-olds in the Chicago areas, 4 of whom were related to Corey. In the February 1982 edition of American Psychologist, Dr. Eron reports that girls now show the same effect as boys. The more violence they watch on TV, the more aggressive is their behavior. Moreover, Dr. Eron indicates this relationship between TV violence and children's aggression has recently been confirmed for both sexes in parallel studies being carried out in Finland, Poland, and Australia. I didn't know people lived in Finland, Poland, and Australia. In 1982, the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, everything needs a Russia tape to sound important, issued a major report, Television and Behavior, summarizing over 2,500 studies done since 1972 on the influence of television. The results led NIMH to conclude, there is now an overwhelming evidence of causal link between children's watching television violence and their performance of violent acts. Okay, so I'm not going to read you all the maiselach over here. Here is Brandon Tarkentoff, president of NBC, quoted in the New York Times. Television did have an effect on me right from the beginning. In the first grade, I was a member of a 4-kid gang that went around imitating TV westerns. We disrupt class to play out scenes, picking up chairs and hitting people over the head with them. Except, unlike on TV, the chairs didn't break. The kids did. Finally, the teacher called in my parents in and said, obviously he's been influenced by these TV shows, and if he's to continue on this class, you have to agree not to let him watch television anymore. So from the first to second grade, there was a dark period during which I wouldn't watch TV at all. And I calmed down, and the gang broke up. Let's skip more about violence. Next, put number 3. Put-downs are funny. There's always been wisecracking on TV, but with the flood of sitcoms, it's reached a new high or low. When Archie called Edith, where's that from?
All in the Family.
Excellent, excellent. When Archie called Edith a ding-a-ling on All in the Family, he helped usher in the era of the put-down. What's a put-down in the Torah? An Isser Daraisa. Usher men HaTorah put somebody down. TV lab tracks teach kids that these insulting remarks are funny and cool. And parents and teachers will attest that kids putting each other down is a major cause of interpersonal problems at home and at school. I remember, you know, to this day, I sometimes go up to students when I'm being less compassionate, and I'll say, not you, Corey, but I'll just use you as you don't mind as my...
Right on.
Anyone home over there, McFly? At home? Oh, it used to be. I know there was a movie once.
Back to the Future.
Yeah. So therefore, you learn put downs. It's a rotten world. George Comstock, writing in Character Magazine, argues that TV gives kids a jaundiced view of society, which may help to explain why they have so little respect for authority figures and traditional social institutions. In its news coverage, for example, TV focuses almost exclusively on the bad news, the riots, the strikes, the congregant facing a bribery charge, the disgraced president waving a last farewell. This was before the disgraced president was doing other things. It thereby portrays a world of turmoil and dishonesty to which cynicism may seem the appropriate response. In its entertainment shows, television often depicts established authority as corrupt. In a recent study by Robert and Linda Lichter, two George Washington University sociologists, probably pronounced Lichter, I don't know if Graham can do the huh, found that businessmen, professionals, and policemen plan or commit nearly half the criminal offenses portrayed on TV.
Sorry, could you repeat that sentence? Yeah,
that two sociologists found that businessmen, professionals, and policemen plan or commit nearly half the criminal offenses portrayed on TV. Which means that when you meet... I remember once I read an article in the newspaper about Hasidim who were involved in sexual offenses. And then I walked down the street for the next few days, and every time I'd see a Hasid, I would say, that sick man, you know, that depraved individual. Because I'd read in the newspaper, how many Hasidim are really morally depraved? Let's say less than 1%. Which would make a lot, even if there are a lot. I don't think there are. But it's definitely less than 1%. And that's the only ones they're writing about in the newspaper. They don't have articles in the Jerusalem Post about Tzaddik and Mimei Sha'arim, who learn all day and do chesed all night. Yes, they only have the articles about the criminals. And that's what people begin to look at Hasidim as criminals, because that's what they have in the newspapers. Also, that your kids learn on TV. Oh, not surprisingly, television also heightens anxiety. A 1979 study by the Foundation for Child Development in New York found that children who are heavy TV viewers are more fearful of the world and more apt to have bad dreams than kids who see less television. When I was a kid, I remember I was always terrified of, first of all, being kidnapped.
American Most Wanted.
Yeah, true.
I couldn't sleep for a week after watching an episode.
Right. I remember I was always afraid of being kidnapped because I'd watch shows of kids who were kidnapped. And there was a kid in my age, a Jewish kid in New York, who was kidnapped. And his parents were looking for him for years. And the New York Post covered the story. His name was Paz, I remember. And, well, they thought he did in magazines, like magazines of...
Album?
No. The ones where they show pictures of people sleeping with each other and porn magazines. They thought they saw pictures of him, but I never found out that they located him. But the parents were distraught, because they couldn't find their kid, and if that was their kid in those magazines, then it's even worse. So it could be they killed him, or it could be they made him into some type of animal. So that was what I grew up with, all that fear, and then you have nightmares. Next, women are inferior. While blacks and other minorities have generally improved their TV image, women still take a beating, literally. Female TV characters, one study showed, are twice as likely as men to display incompetence, both in programs and in commercials. Next, kids learn that adults are adults. The next time you watch quote-unquote family comedy shows, ask yourself, who's smarter here, the grown-ups or the kids? As Newsweek quips, TV has gone from father knows best to father knows least. When they're not depicted as dumb, parents are often represented as narrow-minded, racist, or self-centered persons. We could hardly be surprised if kids brought up on such stereotypes fail to look upon adults as a source of wisdom and advice. Next, life is entertainment. Kids who spend 30 hours a week sitting in front of a TV set are spending a good portion of their time being passively entertained. As a result, they're less likely to be able to amuse themselves or to develop the disciplined capacity for hard thinking and hard work that productive life requires. That's why it's hard for me to get a young man to sit in front of a Gemara that has no graphics and just words and abstract concepts and try to get them to think, because we're so used to pictures. And you know, in a movie and a TV show, I once read that every 2 or 3 seconds they change the camera and the view, because people get bored when watching the same thing for too long. So they have to show from this side and from that side and from this angle, from that angle, and he's saying this and he's saying that, and there has to be a constant stream of excitement. And then when you have to sit and read a book, it's not so easy anymore. In the olden days, in the dorms, people used to read books because they didn't want to learn, but at least they were reading. But today you don't even have to read anymore, because even though I heard they were outlawed, but DVDs are much easier than reading. They're more likely to think that gratification in life should be as quick and easy as turning on a show. 8. Drinking is where it's at. A University of Michigan study found that even though kids can now see up to 40 sexual encounters a week on TV, they can see even more drinking. In crime shows, alcohol is consumed on the average of 4 times an hour.
It's funny that the University of Michigan says that, because that's like one of the biggest parties.
Right. 33% of all beverages drunk on TV are alcoholic. I remember when I used to watch sports, every commercial was a beer commercial. A beer commercial or a car commercial. So if you can't afford the car, at least the beer you can afford. The highest rate of alcohol consumption occurs during prime time and on the top 10 shows. Meanwhile, communities across the country face the problem of kids who drink more at an earlier age than ever before. Things make you happy. In TV commercials, the average child sees 20,000 a year, which incidentally leads kids to want to buy things they don't really need, and their parents end up spending money needlessly. And in programs, kids are constantly shown all the material things there are to have, and led to believe that these things once possessed will make them happy, or the pretty girl will make them happy, or the handsome guy.
You'll get the pretty girl because you have this thing also.
Uh-huh. TV materialism may even lead kids to think that they're entitled to all of the goodies that everyone else seems to have. Recall the common teenage justification for shoplifting. We have a right to the material things in life, quote unquote. Obviously, we can't blame everything on TV. Kids can get bad examples and shoddy values from lots of sources. But obviously from other people who watch TV. But we're fooling ourselves if we don't think that television is part of the problem. What's lost as a result of TV? So, here is Uri Bronfenbrenner, poor man, Bronfenbrenner. Cornell University's expert on the family helps us stand back and see the grip TV has come to have in our family life. Like the sorcerer of old, the television casts its magic spell, freezing speech and action, and turning the living into silent statues so long as the enchantment lasts. The primary danger of the television screen lies not so much in the behavior it produces as the behavior it prevents, the talks, the games, the family festivities and arguments through which much of the character of the child's learning takes place and his character is formed. You know, people often wonder about the kids in the Rova. They learn the entire Tanakh by heart by the time they're 10 years old. They say, oh, wow, that's so amazing. How do they know that? Just yesterday, my child was entertaining some Shanabet boys in the base matters. He's 5 years old, and he was learning the Parsha by heart. So, oh, wow, isn't that neat? So what's the answer? The answer is not that all the kids in the world are brilliant. Not all the kids can be like my kids. But rather, that they just don't have they don't have a TV. They don't have a TV. So what else are they going to do with their time? So they sit and they learn. One survey cited in Television Movie Facts for Parents found that parents across the country talk seriously, quote unquote, to their children less than 3 minutes a week. They're watching TV. It may be a hard fact to face, but kids from TV as their constant companion may feel a stronger attachment to the tube than they do to us. In a study by Dr. Young Bay Ray, ask Rav Shaloni. One time Rav Shaloni got into an accident with somebody by the name of Sing Ding Ling, some Chinese guy. Ask him about the name. It's a very funny story to him. 44% of the 4 to 6 year olds interviewed said they liked TV more than they liked their fathers.
A few years. You have to bear in mind that probably 6% of kids have.
Probably.
Wait,
4 to 6 year olds.
What's the percentage?
What? They're right, exactly. A few years ago, Bill Moyers' journal asked elementary school children, if you had to give up one of these for the rest of your life, Which did you give up, watching TV or talking to your father? About half of the children answered, talking to my father. Now, this is where we get to the end, even though there's obviously a lot more to say. But this is where we get to the end. So what can I do about TV? What can we do to keep TV from dominating our family life and taking over as our children's major moral teacher? First, be mindful of the fact that watching begets watching. Research shows that parents who are heavy watchers tend to have children who are heavy watchers. Parents who are light watchers tend to have kids who are light watchers. So what else can we do? Some families have reduced TV viewing by keeping the set in a hard-to-get-out place, like a closet. Definitely not in the child's bedroom. I always wanted a TV in my room, and my parents never let me have one. I called the social worker, but it never worked out. Some have...
Did you really call a social worker? No.
I know someone
who would call the social worker for almost the same reason.
He called
right, and then they have more H's here. Get your spouse... keep a TV log for a week, recording who watches what for how long. Propose a let's see what happens experiment, no TV for 2 weeks. Get together. The kids are, here he has. And then he has lists of what to do instead of watching TV.
Oh, what does he say?
Read, play, exercise, help with the housework or yard work, have a friend over, do a good deed for a neighbor, do your housework, learn Gemara, practice a musical instrument, play a board game, work on a hobby, cook something special together. Go to a movie.
Go to a movie. He's actually on there.
Play. Concert, a museum. Write a letter.
I think what we have here.
Email.
Monitor what your kids watch. Right? Now. This is what caused the sexual revolution. So good.
I thought it was the cars.
What?
Cars?
Caused the sexual revolution?
Because why? Now it was an easy place for... It was an easy private place for teenagers.
Ah.
I think
Holy Oath.
I don't remember when I heard that shame.
Rabbi Sai.
Pleasantville.
Rabbi Sai. I want now... to ask you, after all that you read here, to tell me what the most logical solution to this problem is. Very simply, what is the most logical solution to this problem?
Go to a movie.
B-chip.
Now everybody is laughing because it's so simple that it makes sense to everybody. What?
Tell your kids.
Yeah, don't have kids, right? Then you won't have a problem.
B-chip.
But he never says it. He never says, don't have a TV. He never says anything positive that comes out of the TV, except maybe it's a babysitter. But all he talks about is how terrible and negative it is, and that it has much more of a negative effect than it does a positive effect. And he doesn't say, just get up and don't have a TV set. And I'm sure, without a doubt, that this fellow, Dr. Thomas Lickena, has a TV set. But the only thing is, at one point he says, he gives one etzah, some other families have brought about the demise of a TV by simply neglecting to repair a set on the blink or taking it to the repair shop and leaving it. I've never heard of a family that wasn't delighted with the results of restricting or eliminating television in their home. Says one mother, it was like an awakening. The children began to choose to play games. Randy, who had never read any more than he had to now, is now into novels. So, I became more involved in hobbies and community activities. I guess we all began to realize that our time is valuable and we should spend it doing things that are important to us. So, and then he starts going on with all these, going around and around and around. Why doesn't he just say, don't have one? It's not the first time. One time I read an article in some magazine and they were talking about all the deleterious and negative effects of television. And... they just couldn't do it. They said, so what should we do? And they couldn't say, don't have one. And it's crazy. Now, these facts... Yes, Dave?
Isn't it like very similar to the same idea of tshuva? Like, with tshuva, you don't... Like, if you're having a major problem with a certain area, you don't say, I'm never going to do that thing.
Of course you do. understand. A person is nikshal and he sleeps with a woman. He says, I'm never going to sleep with this woman again.
The way, I forgot who Rav Aron quoted, but...
The Rambam.
No,
the Rambam said...
It was a... Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, again.
Sorry. It was a letter. It was one of the letters. It was a book of, like, seven letters. It was very big gadol. And a yeshiva bacha wrote in... He wrote in...
Stipler.
A yeshiva bacha wrote in and said he has a very big problem with... and the Stifler said back to him, don't try to eliminate it 100%, because you're not going to be able to. If look at the there's a huge amount of scar, just eliminating one, let's say you're doing it four times, it's happening four times a day,
right.
One.
Now this boy's onus. This boy is having severe psychological. First of all, he has severe problems. And the stipler was trying to make him feel better, to try your best.
No.
But just to not have it, the stipler wasn't saying, like, read books.
No,
what do you suggest?
He's not saying that you shouldn't eliminate it 100%, but you can't start, you can't go to the extreme, because it's not going to, at least, Rishayim Rav Baroni says this, I talked to him a little bit about it. He says you can't go to an extreme, because it's not going to hold up. The kid said he'd never do it again. Even normal kids, it's not a realistic goal. He has to work on it and slowly, and make. Everyone seems to be into this idea of make. What's it called? Win. No, like win battles for yourself. Make the battle something you can win, and then keep moving your boundaries outward and outward. So I think it might be the same idea here. No one who reads it is going to throw out their TV. But maybe they'll start limiting, like to 1 hour a week, and then more and more.
So you're being malamei tzchus, but. When you're trying to improve a character trait, so then you're right, you take it step by step. But here, it's just a matter of taking a box and throwing it in the garbage, because you know that it's bad for you. It's like a person has poison in his house. He knows that he has poison in his house. He doesn't say, let's remove it little by little and hope the kids in the meantime, you know, that doesn't hurt them too much. He gets rid of all of it. But I'm not talking about...
The idea is that people are... If he said that, if all he said was... This is bad for this and this and this and this.
People wouldn't listen.
Don't ever do it.
Uh-huh.
No one's going to listen to him.
Uh-huh.
No one's going to be Macaulay.
He's
not going to be able to.
Uh-huh. I hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yes, Rav Yaakov.
I want to say something similar to what you just said. Anyway, yeah. But like, character trait, which is bad, is like internal. The TV is external. I mean, before I came to Israel, I watched a lot of TV. And I came to Israel and there's no TV here. I didn't start going crazy. Oh my God, I don't have a TV. I used to watch 10 million hours a day, and I'm watching 0 hours a day, I'm going crazy. No, I didn't have a TV, so
Of it. Right. Wait, so it could be, thank you for adding that, Yaakov. It could be that David is correct and he's learning a good source on Thomas Lacona. But all of us are going to have our own children. Now, let me take one step back. Every couple, when they get married, knows these statistics. Everybody knows this. It's not a secret. Nobody's surprised. Oh, really? TV has a lot of bad things that kids should... Everybody knows. Is there anybody here who knows more than two families that don't have television sets for any reason other than religious reasons? In other words, for halachic reasons, not very religious families. You know two families?
They happen to be religious families, but the reasons they're doing it isn't religious.
Aren't religious reasons. So you know more than two, and you?
Yeah. I know one.
You know one.
Yeah.
But will...
I know people
who don't
want their kids brainstorming and much.
So to tell a person who already has one, so it's hard, so then we try to monitor it like David said. But everybody knows the statistics, and yet when people get married, everybody gets a TV, just about everybody, except we have a couple of examples of very, very, very less than 1% of the population. I don't know anybody. When I was growing up, I never met anybody without a TV set, and except I had cousins in Bnei Brak, but they don't count as people. I'm saying any regular, saying at the time, that's how I looked at it. And then I remember I came to yeshiva here, and I remember I met a kid, I couldn't believe it. I came from a very religious family, they didn't have a TV set, he was from Brooklyn. I never heard of such a thing in my life. I never ever heard of such a thing in my life. None of my friends, nobody, and I had friends whose fathers were rabbis, doctors, lawyers, everything. So the parents know the statistics. They know their kids are watching, and if you ask them, do you think that it's good that a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old should be watching things, they'll all say no. Everybody knows the facts, and yet they still have one. Now, if you're going to say to me, the parents, it's too late. They're already addicted, so they have to have one for themselves. But why would they let their kids ever start watching it? Because you're right, once you start, as David said, so then it's already hard to stop, and then you have to monitor, and you have to lower it. But not to start in the first place, like Yaakov said, once he's here, he doesn't feel like he needs it anymore. It's not around. It's not accessible. Or my own children. Anybody whose children didn't grow up with it, they don't ever say, oh, I'm bored. I want to watch TV. Right? They don't even know such a thing either. I mean, they know it exists, but they're not interested. It's not part of their lives. So even though everybody knows it's bad for you, everybody still does it. Everybody still has one in their house, and everyone's kids are watching it. And then even though they know what an effect it had on them, and we all know the nightmares, and we all know all the scenes we saw, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and yet almost every boy, and I've been doing these chuk for years, almost every boy who comes out of the chuk, unless for religious reasons, but they all end up having TVs. Almost everybody. I remember one boy, he came back, and he said he was learning with Rav Darmoni. Rav Darmoni was convincing him not to have one. Right, so that's already a nice farty boy, and he listens to his Rav Darmoni. But to me, it's unbelievable. So what's the answer? That's why I said I want to use this as a paradigm to a greater subject. Not that TV is bad for you. That goes without saying. Yes, Eliezer Ben Shlomo Levi.
I don't agree with TV, but also a lot of the things you describe, you also seen Tanakh as well.
So the answer is that in Tanakh there is stories of sin, and the Tanakh teaches you that people who did the sin get very heavily punished, and it tells you not, it's not doing it for entertainment purposes, it's doing it to teach you a lesson. So since these things exist in this world, so therefore in order to learn the lesson of what exists in this world, we have to learn the Tanakh. Now when we teach kids Tanakh, also we teach them, we make it age appropriate. So therefore, even though let's say my son, he's 7, he knows just about Chamisha Chumshei Torah, but if you ask him how to have a baby, he has no idea. He doesn't have a clue how to have a baby. So what does he say? He says when they get to a story in the Tanakh, in the Chumash, about two people, he says they got married. And then when there's a story of rape, they raped Dina, it says that he married Dina. We tell him, the teacher tells him, he marries Dina. He doesn't go into explicit graphic detail of exactly what happened. Right? I assume you know the story of Dina was raped. Yes. And the story of Lot and his Lot and his two daughters. And so what do we say? That Lot got married to his daughters. And the kids learn that it's not good to marry your daughter. So but they don't go into graphic detail. So also right, and also the story of Yehuda and Tamar. So you would have married Tamar?
I only learned that story about 2 or 3 years ago. When did they find out? Wait, why did we...
So when they get old enough...
Jack,
I thought it like a rabbi.
It's the black.
Oh, clearly.
So that is all about Tanakh. And also, since it's Torah, it won't... Since it's Kedusha and it's done in an atmosphere of Kedusha, it won't hurt. And other, I think in today's world, it's more important to learn these things because people should learn about it in a holy context, and not in an impure context. That's why. Next, I want to use this not for. Now, I've never actually heard. I've discussed this with parents before. I've never actually heard parents say, "No, I think TV is a good thing. I think it's good. I think it's teaching. I think it's imparting valuable lessons to the children, and we want them to act like the characters on television." Nobody's ever said that. Let's somehow Jack buy. Can you Nelson Melech maybe get up?
It's good for the news.
Oh, so even the news...
Yeah, I know it's all negative, but say that when world disaster was happening.
What?
9/11.
What?
Like 9/11.
No, so you can find out what's going on in the world without having a TV.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, you can only really appreciate it if you see it. You know, like, hearing on the radio, you don't really...
Why do you have to appreciate one? You can see pictures in TV.
I've never seen what happened.
Neither have I. How am I supposed to see? I don't have a TV. I still have pictures. But no, I think it's important to know what's going on in the world. But for that, a person can read the newspapers, and it also to question what newspaper. So what do I want to use this as a paradigm for? How things everybody agrees upon, and yet it has no effect on their practical lives, even though people know it's true. So first example is TV. All parents know TV is bad for their kids, and yet all parents, just about all parents, let their children watch. Next. Death. Now, most people would agree that people die. It's a well-known fact.
That's definitely true.
That's definitely true.
I think we need
Right. So, and yet, most people don't ever want to deal with it. They want to avoid the whole thing of death. Now, everybody would agree that you're dead for a lot longer than you're alive for. Because we all know about people who have been living now for many, many thousands of years. And they're all dead. Most of them are dead. And they've been dead, many of them, for a long, long time. And it's very definitive. You know, when they bury somebody in Israel, they put them in the ground. They don't have a coffin. They just put their body under the ground. Then they put these stones on top of them, these bricks. And then they put sand, and they just keep, you know, they have sand 6 feet high. And then they can't get out, even if they were alive, they couldn't get out. So they're there, and so there's a finality to it. So now I'm talking about Jewish people. I'm not talking about the Gentiles. So the average, say, modern Orthodox parent. So they know that there's death. And if you ask them, if you pin them down, you say, do you believe in, you know, the afterlife in Schar V'Onesh? Most people believe on some level in reward and punishment. So sometimes, you know, you'll talk to them, not your own parents. I'm not really talking about anybody individual's parents. I'm talking about someone else's parents. You'll talk to them about, let's say their child wants to learn in yeshiva. And they'll say, no, I have to worry about my child's future. I want my child to have a good future. So I'll say, I also want your child to have a good future. His future forever. That's eternity. You're worrying about an uncertain future from age 22 to age 82. It's an uncertain future because nobody knows what tomorrow will bring. And I'm concerned with a definite future, because he's definitely going to, I don't know if he's going to make it from 22 to 82, but to die, he's definitely going to die. And then once he's there, he's going to be there for a lot longer than 60 years. People are dead for a long, long time. Every second, my great, 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 great grandfather died, and that was it. I'm still waiting for him to come. He still hasn't come back. So he's been lying there now for 500 years, and sorry, not great, 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 five. That was a great sneeze. Oh, so nice. So he's been lying there. Joking. He's been lying there for 10. He's been, you know what I'm saying? People die for 5,000 years. They're still dead. So I'm worrying. So I'm worrying about your child, that he should be taken care of. He should be happy for 5,000 years. And which is a vadai, but not 5,000 years. Forever. He'll definitely be dead forever. At least he'll never be in this body the way he is now. Ever again, this physical body we have now is very, very, very temporary. And your concern, so I'm worried about the definite eternal soul body. I mean, we have Tchisa Mason, which might be with the body. And you're only worried about his possibility of the next 60 years. So who loves your kid more? Me, who's worried about the definite eternity? Or you, who's worried about a split second? Remember, the rest of our lives compared to eternity is less than a split second. So who would you think loves a person more? Somebody who's worried about them for the next second, or somebody who's worried about them for the rest of their life? So in the same way, we can say, who loves somebody more? Somebody who's worried about them for this world, and somebody's, by the way, and when I say we're concerned with their welfare for the eternity, I'm also concerned with their welfare for this world. The Torah is also, the Torah is specifically to be kept in this world, and that's what this world is about. I want them also to be happy in this world. But I want them to be happy both in this world and in the next world. And you're only concerned with them being happy in this world. What do you say to that, sir? Now, we're dealing with very, very intelligent people, and not your own parents, Chas V'Shalom, but present this to other people, and they'll say to you, young man, you were brainwashed in Israel by those rabbis.
Have you really said that to parents?
No. You know why? Because when I bring up death and all these things, like, they don't want to talk about that. Like, let's talk about here and now. People are very uncomfortable with it because, and the truth is I, and because they're so uncomfortable that I don't bother bring it up, because then they just think you're nutso. Because the Gemara already says that people know that they're going to die, but they don't want to think about it. Like, let's not even talk about that. Let's talk about now. Yeah, what do you mean now? Your kid's definitely going to die. And he'll be dead forever. What about that? What is he going to be doing then? How is his degree? I know your son is going to Harvard. He's a very bright boy. How is his degree from Harvard going to help him in the eternal world? They'll look at you as if you just come from the moon. You're crazy. So they're going to say to you, you've been brainwashed by your rabbis in Israel. They're not going to deal with the issue at hand. They're going to say, you're brainwashed by your rabbis in Israel. And you know what you say to them? You say to them, probably, but speak to them on the phone. See how they do with you. Yeah, give them my number. I'll talk to any of them, right? But see how they do it? Of course you're brainwashed. Of course we're all brainwashed. Everyone in the world is influenced. The question is, what are you influenced by? Are you influenced by logic? Or are you influenced by people who don't want to deal with reality? And Western culture is not dealing with reality. What do they do when somebody dies? They put a tuxedo on him. They put makeup on him. Poor Fred never wore makeup his whole life. You know what I mean? He wasn't a movie star. So they put makeup on Fred, and they lie him in his coffin, and everybody goes up to him, and he looks... Somebody goes up to him, and he goes, Fred! You haven't looked this good in 20 years, Fred! You know what I mean? You look like $1 million! And he says, Fred, you know, it was great knowing you. Goodbye. And everyone says their goodbyes, and then when they shove him in the ground, nobody's there. That's very unpleasant to look at. You know, just a body and this, and the people don't want to... People don't want to deal with that. Death is not a popular topic. And yet, these same people, we said this in the 6 o'clock shir, most Americans believe in the afterlife. They believe in some level in the afterlife. And Jews believe definitely on some level. Again, there are levels of belief. Yes, a person, if they believed it in their heart, then it wouldn't be. They believe it in their mind on some level that there is reward and punishment. That you don't get a reward for getting a college degree. You don't get reward for being rich. And you do get reward for doing good deeds and being a spiritual person. And yet most modern Orthodox parents are much more concerned with their kids being rich and getting a college degree than they are with their kids being a spiritual person and doing good deeds. Now how do you explain that? And they themselves will agree. No, what's more important? Can you be careful with the knife, David? I'm getting very nervous about it. Thank you.
You and me both, Rabbi.
Also, Ben. So that we already had one boy this year who had a second bris. We don't need a second one. So the...
Not very nice, is it?
So, the question is like this.
Cut it out.
People are not dealing with reality. And they just go with their life and they don't like to talk about it. Now, that's usually what they'll do, I'm guessing. If you bring it up, what they'll tell you is that, you know, you've been brainwashed by Israel and this and that and talking about death. And it's such an unpleasant topic. But not only death, but even in life. If you ask somebody, go and ask a person, not about yourself, not when you're talking about Shana Bet, and not when you're talking about being religious. Ask a person in a Friday night Shabbos table conversation. Not even a super religious person. Just the average person. Then I'm not Khalil talking about your parents. Somebody stop in the community. Say to them, what type of person do you value more? A person who's kind, generous, sensitive, caring, loving, spiritual, understanding, a true paragon of kindness and good deeds, or do you value a person who got a master's, is making a lot of money, has a really prominent position in some company, and he's a vice president of Goldman Sachs, drives a really fancy car, and goes on the neatest vacations to places that most exotic places. Who do you value more, the first type of person or the second type of person? Nobody in their right mind would tell you that they value the second type of person more than the first type of person. Everybody likes the kind, sensitive, caring, spiritual person more than they like this guy who's... And what they say, okay, what type of character does this second guy? He's okay. Nothing bad, nothing good. Just average. He's an all right guy. You know what I mean? He does. He gives a little bit of charity every year. You know, some people he says good Shabbos to. Some people he doesn't. Sometimes he insults his wife. Sometimes he doesn't insult his wife. You know, he's an okay sort of guy. Nothing too great, nothing too bad. So they'll say, no, of course, the first guy's a tzaddik. Everybody appreciates a tzaddik. And the second guy is, you know, all right. So what are we trying to produce in a yeshiva? In a yeshiva, all we're concerned, even though we have no problem with anybody making a living and being rich and anyone who wants to, I give everyone a bracha, they should have all the material things they need and want. But in yeshiva, we're trying to produce people who are caring, sensitive, understanding, kind, people who do chesed, people who love other people, people who treat their wives with extreme love and kindness, and people who are devoted to their children and to their communities, people who give large amounts of tzedakah, people who are spiritual, people who try to further moral values, etc., etc. That's what our primary concern is in yeshiva. And in the outside world, what are they trying to produce? People who are just trying to make a lot of money and have a good time. And yet, the majority of parents are concerned with pushing their kids towards that second type of person and not the first type of person, when they themselves will agree that they value the first type of person, the tzaddik, more than the second type of person. And if you tell them Shana Aleph, some parents will say okay right off the bat because everybody's doing it. Some parents will give their kid trouble. And if they say Shana Bet, then usually, more often than not, there's a fight. When all Shana Bet means, it's not a Shana Bet speech, is we're trying to make a person who already is a good person, and we're just trying to make him into a better person, a more quality human being. That's all the yeshiva is trying to do. That's all the Torah is trying to do, is trying to make you lo nidnu a mitzvah selatzarvis abrios. Mitzvahs are here to purify us. And the outside world is trying to create people who are just materialists, if there's such a word. And people are just trying to get ahead. Now again, this doesn't preclude a person having a job and being involved in society, etc. But how can anybody put up a fight to when we're just trying to make their children what they themselves would agree is the better type of human being? So what does it come to? So what's the reason? So the reason is like this, time. There's a number of issues involved. The main one is that people just don't look at it that way. They just don't look at it that way. In other words, they don't look at their only concern with their kids' next 60 years, which is only a possibility and not eternity. They're just concerned with their child. The way they define concern with their child is this worldly concern. When you talk about, you know, let's say a child being in yeshiva versus being in college, they don't look at it as in college they're only teaching moral depravity. That's all that's, I'm saying, any secular college, that's all that's going on in any secular college that I'm familiar with, is drugs, sex, alcohol, parties, fun. And then when they're actually studying, it's only studying to make a lot of money. I never actually met anybody who's in college because he wants to be educated, because he knows that with education he will help create a more upright moral society. I never met, one time there was a bunch of Ramaz kids who were in Yale, and I remember they came to Israel for winter vacation. They didn't come to Israel for the year, they just came to visit their friends over winter vacation. And I said to them, tell me, is anybody actually in Yale studying in order to create a better society? Or is everybody just there to make money and get ahead in life and have a prominent, you know, be able to write on their resume that they went to Yale? He said, well, we have a society in Yale of people who are trying to better the world. And I said, how many in their society? He said, 40 people. Had 40, now I'm sure all these 40, I'm not sure if you see the way these 40 kids behave on the weekends, I'm not sure they're all such tzaddikim either. But all of Yale University, only 40 kids even have a thought to join a society which is trying to make society, which is trying to help the world. And in yeshiva, we're trying to perfect the world, not only the Jewish people. The Jewish people are here for the whole world. So if you read that in the Sudan, there's genocide going on right now, and go call the people in America, send emails, say, what are you doing about that? So what do you mean, what are you doing about that? You know, we're trying to make money. We have season tickets. We have, what month is it now? It's
basketball season.
Is the Super Bowl taking place yet?
February.
We're getting ready.
February. No, it's the last day of January.
Yes. We're getting ready.
This Sunday.
It would be hockey.
This Sunday. We're getting ready for the Super Bowl. Yeah, we're licking our chops. We have, we're planning our Pesach vacation. Should we go to Miami Beach? Should we go to Hawaii? Should we go to the Swiss Alps? You know that. Excuse me. What are you doing about genocide in the Sudan? What do you mean? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Like, I'm going out for dinner Thursday night. You know, we have this really nice restaurant that just opened up in the Five Towns. We're going out to. What are you doing? One second. What are you doing about the? What am I doing? I'll tell you what. I'm in yeshiva. You know what I'm doing? I'm trying to bring more godliness into the world so that very soon Mashiach should come and he should make a world where nobody has to suffer anymore, where nobody has to be hungry, where nobody kills anybody else, where nobody hurts anybody else, where even the wild animals begin to act like human beings. so you can walk in the Arab Shuk without fear. Yeah, that's what it says is going to happen when Mashiach comes. That the wild animals, Vishvati Chaya Raman Aretz, you're going to see a lion, you're going to see a bear, yes? And you're going to go up to him, and you're going to... What?
Drinking tea.
Drinking tea, and you can see you're gonna, the bear is going to give you a bear hug. Yeah? That's what's going to happen. And there's going to be no...
Oh, Rav, you must be lying to me.
Just and then, this this I wouldn't say. This is a little bit. This is a little bit harsh. I wouldn't say this to anybody. Maybe if, maybe people, if they have a strong constitution, they can maybe handle this. But what are you doing? You should write to them to prevent another Holocaust.
I mean,
what are you doing? Yeah, you know, I don't want to talk for a second about Mashiach, but I feel now. You know, if you ever wonder, like, why people act the way they do, there are certain things that are behind it. In other words, this is really the way I think. I'll hear what I'm doing. Before the Holocaust, there was mass assimilation in Eastern Europe. Jews were becoming goyim. Did you know that? And Germany was the worst, but all over. Jews were trying to be like goyim. They thought it was really neat to be like goyim. They were so excited about it. Do you know how many guys in yeshivas? I've said this before at the chug. Yeshiva bachrim. But I'm saying yeshiva bachrim, top guys with great heads, became communists, radicals, everything is besides Judaists. Some of them even went and, you know, they would get their friends in trouble, rabbis in trouble, their parents in trouble. There was a Rebbetzin. A Rebbetzin, the wife of a rabbi, who joined the Esvetskia, the communist police, the Jewish communist police, and she started finding Jews practicing religion and sending them to Siberia. That's what the Jews were up to. And then even during the Holocaust, there were capos. There was a capo. It's a true story. There was a capo who was a chassid. A chassid. When I say chassid, I mean a chassid with a shtreimel and with payas. Who could repeat in I don't know, you don't know the difference between Hasidic, Yiddish, and Lutheran, but he would speak Yiddish, and he could repeat Torahs that his Rebbe said, and he was helping the Nazis, and one time the Nazi said, you know, something about killing his parents, and this boy said, and this man said, he smiled, and he said, I'd be happy to help you. Isn't that a Hasidic boy? It's a Hasidic who went to the Rebbe's tishes. That's what was happening to Jews. Now, not all the Jews were kapos, but there were before. There were many, 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 many Jews were acting like going. There were small numbers, you know. And there was only one. The Chaznish says, Chaznish lived in Lithuania before the war. He says that in all of Lithuania there was one good elementary school, one good firm elementary school. Nobody wanted the girls even more than the boys. Nobody wanted to be Jews anymore. They were all thrilled. They said we're gonna go out into the world, we're gonna go to universities, we're gonna be part of the world, we're gonna show the goyim that we can be just like them, we can be even better than them. So you would have cases of a father sitting with his son on Sunday afternoon, on Saturday afternoon, learning Chumash, and his daughter's in the next room doing her math problems. Yes, not everyone is as smart as Ben Crown that could do math problems in their head. Yes, she's writing them out. Yeah, so that's what was going on in Eastern Europe, not to mention what was going on in America. They estimate that over 90% of all the Russian immigration to America became not religious. Almost everybody became not religious. People who came to America in the 1900s, in the early 1900s, almost all of their children ended up being not religious. So if you're a parent, if you're religious today, it's almost a miracle.
You have the Torah Mada Journal.
Yeah.
There's an article in there about Orthodoxy in America.
Yeah.
It said in the early 30s. There were only 3,000 Orthodox Jews in America.
Really?
That's what it says in the Torah.
Wow. Wow. Right? And there was no yeshivas, and there was nobody learning Torah, and Judaism was almost... And after World War II, they thought Judaism is done. You want to hear? There's an amazing story of a man. I heard the story on numerous occasions. It's a well-known story in the yeshiva world, that a man went into a bookstore, and he went to Yasta in 1947, and he said, "Can I buy a Ketos HaChoshen?" Ketos HaChoshen is like a parish on the Shulchan Aruch, very complex issues and gemaras and kashas and terutzim. So it used to be a classic work in the yeshivas, but You know, 1946, 1947, people weren't really learning it anymore because nobody was in yeshivas anymore. All the people who were learning died out. In America, nothing was going on. In Israel, there were not so many yeshivas. There was Judaism was just a flickering candle. So the store owner, you know, got in a ladder, whatever it was, and he found all the way in the back and the high up an old dusty copy of the Ketzos HaChoshen, and he said, "Sir, I want to wish you a mazel tov. You're the last person ever to buy a Ketzos HaChoshen in America." That's what he said, the last person ever. And then we know today that in America there are people learning, not 1,000, not thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and tens of thousands have learned. If he would see Madison Square Garden in 2 months from now, and how many tens of thousands of Jews are finishing Daf Yomi after having learned the entire Shas, he would never have believed it. So that was the story that I heard. And then I was speaking to my good friend Uri David Fisher, and it turns out that in his family they have that Ketzos HaChoshen. Because it happened to some rabbi from the Tel's Yeshiva in Cleveland, I think, and his family, his grandfather was a student or something, so his family has that very copy of the Ketzos HaChoshen that they thought would be the last one ever sold. So I got really excited when Uri David told me that. I said, oh wow, that's a great end to the story. So therefore, if somebody asks, so what are you trying to do? So you say, well, first of all, I'm trying to prevent another Holocaust. That's what you're doing in Yeshiva, because you don't want to assimilate. You don't want to be like the Goyim. The Torah says not to be like Goyim. When you're in Yeshiva, you're not like a guy. And also, incidentally, before the Spanish Inquisition, the Jewish people were assimilating. As a matter of fact, a lot of times throughout history, the Jews try to assimilate, and then Hashem had to wake up the Goyim and rouse anti-Semitism to remind the Jews who they were. And to this day, a lot of people, their connection to Judaism is through the Holocaust, through a Goy telling us that we're Jewish. So I think that a Jew wanting to be a Jew is a very noble endeavor. And also to want to perpetuate. For somebody says, you know, no, you have to get on with your life, you have to be... Say, wait a second. How would you feel if I told you that I worked for a 5,000-year-old company and I just want to make sure that the company continues to flourish? That's what we're doing. This is the purpose for creation. The purpose for creation is bringing God into the world, and that's what we're doing in yeshiva. So no, a person shouldn't stay in yeshiva their whole life. Part of what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to go to yeshiva, and we're supposed to assimilate, into the goyim, all of the Torah values and all the ideals and all of the kedusha that we can. And then, for those of us who aren't cut out for staying in yeshiva for their whole life, we go out into the world, and then we spread those ideas. And then we end up in Madison Square Garden being one of the Mesayim Me'ashas. So that is what we're trying to do here. And in the outside world, all they're trying to do is make us like goyim. And you should just know, I know it's harsh, but I really believe it's true, at least from my perspective. I know it's true that there are not only a lot of Orthodox Jews who are anti-Semites, who have such negative things to say about religious Jews. I was remembering afterwards, a friend of mine was once on the Yeshiva University basketball team. And you know the guys on the basketball team are the cool guys, you know, the jocks. So there was one guy in the team who was a very religious boy, and he'd gone to like a more black hat yeshiva for high school, and then he ended up in YU. So you know what they used to call him? They used to call him Jew Boy. That's what they used to call him! A guy on the team! It's funny, one of the guys who calls Jew Boy has payas now out to here. But that's what happens sometimes when you're anti-Semitic yourself, so you end up being more Jewish than everybody else. But on the Yeshiva University basketball team, they called a boy who was more religious than Jew Boy. And that's what happens. If you're more religious than your friends, a lot of times in the modern Orthodox world, you get made fun of. We're getting made fun of because you're Jewish. It's anti-Semitism. But not only is there anti-Semitism, but people want us to be, we are raised, all of us, on some level we're raised to be like Goyim. They said we want you to be like Goyim in all ways, and depending on how religious you were brought up, you were told maybe to wear a yarmulke, and maybe to wear tzitzis, and to keep Shabbos, and to marry Jewish. So basically the only difference between you and a Goy is that you're sleeping with a Jewish woman, he's sleeping with a Goyish woman, you're eating kosher chicken, and he's eating pork. But that's really the only, but fundamentally there's no difference. You have to work with them, you have to study with them, you have to go to their schools, you have to talk like them, you have to read the same newspapers they read, you watch the same TV they read, they watch. You know, somebody said to me, you know, you're not going to have a TV? You're gonna cut yourself off from the outside world? Yeah! Yeah, I'm going to cut myself off. Of course I'm going to cut myself off from the outside world. Who wants to be part of that? What do they have to offer us? What do they have? This is theater. What? That's it. I'm not going to be a good person if I don't have theater. So therefore, Rabbi say, all we're trying to do is here. Not all. I mean, it's a lot. But just to make ourselves more Jewish. We're not supposed to be like the Goyim. We're supposed to be different in every way. Do you know why we have a bris milah? To show us that not only is our neshama different than a Gentile, even our bodies should be different. Because the problem is, we look like Gentiles. We have a bone sticking out of the middle of our face. We have funny shaped ears on the side of our face. We have arms, and we look more or less like goyim. But we're not supposed to be like goyim at all. Goyim, and we're not, chalila, nothing against them. But they should try to be like us. I never heard, why don't goyim try to assimilate? And more goyim try acting like Jews. You know, they try to get up more early every morning and learn about, you know, spiritual matters, like a Jew gets up for Daf Yomi, and then pray three times a day, stop in the middle of whatever meeting he has, and no, I'm sorry, we have to have a prayer quorum now. We have to remind ourselves that there's a God. Always to dress in a way, put something on top of his head that reminds him that there's a God in this room.
And
that
Christians wear and keep it.
What?
That's all Christians wear and keep it.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, that's how they get into the Kotel. But, understand, I know a lot of people, they go to work without a yarmulke. You know, Jewish, religious people. I say like this, if you're wearing a yarmulke at work, that reminds you that somebody's over you, and therefore you have to be honest. So if a goy, people are embarrassed. Somebody said to me, I said, you're not allowed to? He goes, no, but I'd be so embarrassed. I said, walk into work on the first day, say hello, my name is, don't give your English name, give your Hebrew name. My name is Schneier Zalman Weinberg. That's my name, not Stevie Weinberg. Schneier Zalman Weinberg. And I'm an Orthodox Jew, and I wear this skull cap to remind me, A, always to be honest in business. I don't ever want to cheat. I don't want to, you know, I know this company has a lot of money, and I would never ever want to take a nickel from this company that I didn't earn. B, I wear this thing on my head to remind me never to say anything to anybody else in the office that might hurt their feelings. Right? Because you know, you never want to say anything to hurt their feelings. Yes? C, I'm wearing this on my head to remind me that I'm in this world for a higher purpose, and there's more to life than just making money. And that I also want to be a good person, and I want to be a kind person, and that when I make money here, I'm not just doing it in order to be rich and feel good about being rich, but afterwards I want to give charity, and I'm knowing that I'm doing this in order to advance my children's moral education. And say, that's why I'm wearing this skull cap on my head. So, does anybody in this room think that I should take it off and forget all those things? That's what happens when you take it off. There's no reason for you to remember. That's the tzitzis also. It's supposed to remind you. So therefore I know it's easy for you to say, Rav Ali, that you have a job where it's easy for you to wear a yarmulke, so you can run around telling people to wear a yarmulke at work. It's true. I do have a job where it's easy for me to wear a yarmulke, and nobody gives me any trouble for doing so. But even when you're in the outside world, I think it's something very positive. And one shouldn't not only not be embarrassed, one should be proud of it. I was once a boy in Yeshivat in the old place, who he was a soldier. And he was killed tragically at age 19. And afterwards, they found his diary. So he was an Israeli boy. And when he came to yeshiva, he wasn't so religious. He wasn't so into it. And then he started learning. He got more into it. And they printed his diary, and he showed how he was becoming more serious about his learning and about his avodas Hashem. And at one point, he said, you know, he started wearing his tzitzis out. So somebody said, like, what do you wear your tzitzis out? You have to show off that, you know, you have to show off your tzitzis. What are you wearing your tzitzis out for? He said, yeah. Yeah, I have to show up. I'm proud of it. The Chafetz Chaim says that if a king gives you a present, gives you a medal, everybody likes to show, oh, I got this medal from the king. So he says the same thing. The tzitzis are our medal. Hashem gave us this special gift. We're proud of it. Somebody said, what, are you proud of it? He says, yeah, I'm proud of it. You're trying to show off that God gave it to you? Yeah, I'm trying to show off. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. Why should a person be embarrassed? He should be proud of the fact that he's Jewish. And if people were proud of the fact that they were Jewish, then they would act more like Jews. So these are just a few examples, and you can think more. I think if you look at the world from a different perspective and you try to get into other people's heads, you'll see that people ultimately would agree with you. Everything I said tonight, people would agree. I think most Orthodox, even as modern as they may be, would agree with what I'm saying, right? If you ask them, you ask a Jew, is it important that we should have good educators, good Jewish educators? Every parent would agree, yes. They're sending their kids to a Jewish school. So one time in my shul, they asked, how many people here would want their kids to go into Jewish education? How many people? So I think one or two people raised their hand. Now, I know one guy who did, and this guy's kid is in Kollel, and he's a multimillionaire, and he doesn't help his son, this guy. Why? Because he said he wants his son to be in Jewish education, not to be sitting and learning. Sitting and learning is wasting your time. But at least to be in Jewish education. But at least on, you see that people believe Jewish education is important, and yet nobody actually wants their son to be a Jewish educator. Let somebody else do that. Yes? And then when some guy gets up sitting learning Torah, he says, even though, yeah, to teach Torah, yes, but not to learn Torah. So therefore, my dear friend, at least the best of my analogy doesn't help, but I'm not sure. Maybe he does. Maybe I'm wrong. But all I'm saying is that most people would agree, but they're just not thinking of it this way. They're just not thinking of it. They're thinking of it from their own perspective, or they're not thinking of it. Like, for example, death. People who aren't thinking about death, so therefore they can't relate to what I'm saying. But if you think about it, that's the future. That's the real future. So if people ask, when you send your kid to a good Jewish school, not like you went to a real good Jewish school, and you say, what about his future? He has to get an advanced secular education. So you say, no. First and foremost, I'm worried about his eternal future. And in this world, he'll manage. In this world, I know a lot of people who didn't go to, they didn't go to top colleges, and they eat. They eat. I think about it sometimes when I'm eating. I'm thinking, what does a multimillionaire have more than me? I have enough food to fill my stomach, and he has enough food to fill his stomach. I not only have enough food to fill my stomach, I have enough food to fill my stomach and eat more, but it's going to give me a tummy ache. And he has enough food to fill his stomach 1,000 times, and it's going to give him 1,000 tummy aches. So therefore, he's not going to eat more than he needs to, and I'm not going to eat more than I need to. So what does he have more than me? So, to be rich, it's really overrated anyway. Yes, all of these fancy things, unless, obviously, you do good things with your money. So, people aren't going to go hungry. They're going to have enough to fill their stomach, and that's all they need. So, Rabbi Yisai, I think that it's kedai to think about what we discussed today. And also, when you get back, Mitzvah Shem, you go back for Pesach. You go back. Don't have these discussions with your parents, because sometimes they might get hot, but have with other people, and you'll see how people don't want to deal with the issues, or will say things that are totally illogical. Or, as most people, are just living cognitive dissonance, where on one hand they say they believe in it, and they keep the mitzvahs, and on the other hand they don't keep the mitzvahs. So they're half a Jew and half a guy, and half a Jew and half a guy is, like they say, Rivka lived, she was upset, because whenever she went by a house of Avodah Zarah, it was a kick. And whenever she went to a shul, it was a kick. So she went to the base Shem Be'ever, and she asked the Navi, like, what's going on over here? And they told her, don't worry about it. You have two kids, one's great and one's not so great. So how did that make her feel better? Who wants to know that she has a kid who's going to kick out of Avodah Zarah? How does that make her feel better? So they used to say a joke that Rivka was afraid. She thought she had a kid who was going to be half a Jew, half a guy. Sometimes shul, sometimes the church, sometimes the ballpark, sometimes the Beis Medrash. He was really never anywhere. He didn't really care so much about anything because he wanted to do everything. So that she was worried about. And he said, no, you don't have to worry about it. Your kid who's going to be a Jew is going to be a real Jew. And your kid who's going to be a guy is going to be a real guy. So you don't have to worry about it. At least each person is going to be really them. So therefore, Rabbi Zai, I encourage all of us to really try, think about it. And if you have any comments or anything you want to tell me, I would love to hear it in the... now or any future date. So Yashir Kochachem to all of you for coming, and we will now say the evening service, and I thank you from the depths of my heart always for making my Monday night so special.